I had thought to speak a little bit about this a line of teaching that I got from my teacher, the monk that I'm, a Burmese monk that I've been seeing for the last few years. And there's a lot in it, and maybe I'll speak a little bit about that, but then I really would like to hear where you are, because I think it's, in the short time we have together, if I can directly address your questions, concerns about practice or the Dharma, then I think it'll be maybe more helpful than just listening to something that may not be so helpful. So let me speak a little bit about the topic that I had thought I'd speak about, and then I want to open the floor to questions so that I can really hear where you're at and address Dharma guidance or instruction or understanding to that. Does that sound okay? Yeah. Okay. So the line of teaching that I wanted to comment on is, the mind is not yours, but you're responsible for it. Now, when I say, or when we hear this, the mind is not yours, we can get a little reactive. Because, what do you mean the mind is, well, we can get a little confused initially. What do you mean the mind is not yours? The mind is not mine. What do you mean? This is my mind, right? I mean, I think my thoughts. I make my decisions. I feel my emotions. Don't we? Of course. Kind of. But when we look at what the activity of the mind really is, what is it that the mind is? What is it that the mind does? What is the mind's capacity? How do we experience the mind? And what about all of that makes it mine? Personalized, me. Well, the mind is, in its broadest kind of like easiest definition, it is what is present in you that is not in a corpse. Now, you take a recent corpse just kind of laying here, and there is a body, and there's eyes and ears, and there's hair, and there's, you know, all of the internal organs, and it's all there, and it might even still be warm, and all that, except that corpse doesn't know anything. And hopefully, you do. Right? And that's the difference. That's the mind. It is the mind that knows. Without the mind, this thing called human being ceases to be, even though the body is still there. But just a corpse, a body without a mind, we don't give it much credibility. I mean, we respect it, we take care of it, we, you know, handle it properly. But it's not a very interesting thing. You know, it has no feeling, it has no thoughts, it has no emotions, it has no aspirations, it has no, it doesn't sense, it doesn't hear the sounds outside, it doesn't smell the flowers, it doesn't know that we're around. The mind is gone. It's not there. And so, in this entity that's sitting here in the room tonight, there is this corpse and a mind. So everything that is being known at this time is known through the activity of the mind. Everything that you recognized during the 40 minutes that we sat still was known and recognized by the mind. That is the activity of the mind. So the pure knowing is the mind. The activity of the mind is thinking, feeling sensations in the body, seeing visual images through the eyes, hearing sounds through the... Hearing is the mind. Okay? Seeing is the activity of the mind. Feeling sensations in the body is the activity of the mind. Thinking is the activity of the mind. Feeling emotions is the activity of the mind. All of these occur quite spontaneously. Do you hear the traffic outside? Do you have to do anything special in order to hear that traffic outside? No. We don't have to kind of make the hearing happen. The hearing happens automatically. The mind is present. Sounds are striking the ear. Hearing is known. What makes the functioning of the mind so personal? What makes it yours particularly? Because the hearing happens automatically. You sit still for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 15, 30, 40 minutes, and the body begins to ache. You know, you get painful knee, and sore back, and right? And we recognize that automatically. It's not like we have to say, now I'm going to turn my attention to recognize the pain in my knee. It's like the pain in the knee calls the attention of your mind to it, doesn't it? You know it automatically. You don't have to do anything special to feel pain or to feel pleasure, to hear sounds, to even understand the words that I'm saying. It all happens automatically. Why do we insist on claiming this activity of knowing as mine, my knowing? I'm doing this. It's my mind. Now we can expand the range of what is known to emotion. And, you know, all of us have felt sad, angry, fearful, confused, calm, love, hate, frustration, disappointment, jealousy, envy, joy, ecstasy. We've all felt these at different times. And we felt them due to certain conditions. Certain things happen that are known, are recognized, and sadness comes to the mind. It is a natural occurrence for sadness to come to the mind when certain things happen. Or when other things happen, it is a natural occurrence to feel love. And yet, we all have this habit of insisting that it's my sadness. It's my love. It's my jealousy. And yet, any person in the same situation, experiencing the same conditions, would feel the same thing. The mind, well, it's really not yours. It just operates automatically. Born as a human being, a mind comes with the package, and here it is. Knowing happens from birth to death. There's a continual stream of things happening, things being known. Some are pleasant, some are unpleasant, some are familiar, some are novel, some are gross, some are subtle, some are inner, some are outer, some are physical, some are mental, some are emotional. All kinds of thoughts, all kinds of plans, all kinds of memories. It's just, well, the list of things that can be known is just endless. And almost every one of them we claim to be mine. My sadness, my body, my sensations, my fear, my thoughts, my plans, my aspirations, my memories. And every one of us in the room has the same kind of automatic, occurring, knowing, happening all the time. You know, I could bring someone in here that, you know, 50% of you would hate and 50% of you would really approve. Doesn't mean that there's, you know, a difference. There's a difference in your reaction to the person, but not in the knowing of the person. It happens automatically. Even your reactions happen automatically. Where does your reaction, I say yours in a general sense, where does your reaction of dislike arise when you think of your, most disliked politician? Think of the politician you like the least. I won't tell you who mine is, but you can have your own. Where does that dislike come from? Or think of the person that you love the most. Where does that come from? What makes it so personal that we have this emotional relationship to someone? The knowing that the mind does, the capacity of the mind to know is automatic. We can't do anything to enhance it. We can't do anything to stop it. I mean, when you're feeling pain or you're feeling fear, in some ways we'd love to be able to turn it off. Or when you have insomnia, we'd like to be able to just say, mind, shut up, and turn it off. And we can't. We can't control the mind. The mind is not ours to control. In the sense of what is being known, how it's being known, or even the act of knowing, not yours to play with. In one sense, we could say, we just have to endure the mind. Think about it. Because a lot of what we have to endure of the mind's knowing is not very pleasant. Fear, insecurity, all those painful emotions that, you don't have to be a teenager to have them flooding through the mind. Even we adults still have emotions. And, so you get the picture. You know, the mind is not yours. It thinks, it plans. You can't stop it from thinking. You can't stop it from planning. You can't stop the mind from remembering. I suppose you could take drugs. Or you could just drink yourself silly. But you know what? The mind still works. Even when you're taking drugs and you're doing drinking, and even when you're meditating and you're absorbed in some fantastic spiritual experience, the mind is still knowing. There's no escape from the mind. You can't get away from it. You can't shut it off. You can't stop it. It does what it does automatically. Now, is that true? Is what I've been telling you true? It's pretty convincing, isn't it? I mean, in a way, it's pretty convincing that, geez, that's right. It is kind of like that. But really, let me ask you, is it true? Should we take a vote? Maybe the majority wins. If the majority of you think it's true, then it is. If the minority of you think it isn't, then it really isn't. So how many think that what I've been saying is true? Well, how many think that it is definitely not true? Definitely not true. And how many of you really don't know? Okay. Huh. Interesting. Interesting. Now I know what I'm up against. Okay. Nevertheless, whether it's true or not, and this is the important part of the line of teaching, whether it's true or not, you are responsible for what goes on in your mind. I say responsible for because we're the ones who suffer the consequences of what we do with our mind. If we're careful, we pay attention, we cultivate wholesome or skillful, beneficent qualities of mind, then we get to enjoy those beneficent, wholesome qualities of mind. Understanding, patience, love, joy, connectedness, fulfillment, appreciation, gratitude, generosity. When you feel those feelings, you feel good. Life has meaning. Life has purpose. You feel connected. You feel like waking up and moving through the day. On the other hand, if we're not very careful, or if we're not paying very close attention, we could easily let our mind remain entangled in thoughts of fear, anger, jealousy, blame, criticism, isolation, right? I mean, those thoughts come at different times. And if we're not careful, they can take over our mind and we become depressed and disconnected and alone or lonely, fearful, and this is just the mind. And yet, we can exercise some responsibility for our mind. You know, you cannot blame your partner, your parents, the government, your employer, your boss, your kids, your dog. You can't blame anyone for what you experience. It's your mind. It's your responsibility to deal with what comes up in the mind. It's not to say that you should be able to control the mind and never feel fear, never feel alone, never feel jealous, never feel insecure. That's not possible. You're a human being, things change, you're definitely going to experience them at some time. Definitely. There isn't anybody in this room that hasn't felt them and isn't going to feel them again. But how can we know that and accept responsibility for what goes through the mind so that we don't get entangled, so that we don't get caught, so that we don't suffer unnecessarily with this pretty impersonal functioning of the mind? Only, and here's the answer, only by paying attention. If we don't recognize what's going through the mind, we will be jerked around by it. You know, a lot of times that we're moving through life, you know, you're going just commuting to work, just minding your own business, commuting to work, and you get caught in traffic jam and you're going to be late for an appointment, and the mind gets anxious. It gets fearful. It starts blaming. It starts feeling frustrated. And you start feeling like you're in a rush, even though the car isn't moving any faster because you feel that. Right? I mean, that's what happens to me. Does that happen to you? No. Yes? Okay. I'm not so different, am I? No. Okay. All that extra feeling of rushing, disappointment, frustration, that's suffering. At some level, that is just struggling with the way things are, being discontent, not being at ease. The mind is agitated. It's hot. And we don't do our best in those states of mind, coming from those states of mind. We don't speak the most carefully. We don't act the most carefully. We don't even think the most clearly. We don't make the best decisions. And so it's only lucky if we make the right choices in life, if we're not paying attention. But if we pay attention and we recognize this is the condition, this is the kind of circumstance where my mind or the mind gets fearful or the mind gets anxious or the mind gets jealous or the mind gets angry. If we recognize, oh, this is the kind of situation, these are the conditions that bring up this state of mind, then we can be responsible and say, wait a minute, everything in the momentum of my life, the momentum of conditions in my life or the people around me or the conditions around me is moving towards anger arising. You can know that. You can feel that. You can see it. You can recognize it as familiar pattern in the mind. Then you can do something about it. You don't have to get angry. You can see everything moving the mind in that direction, but you don't have to get caught there. But if you're not paying attention, if you're not paying attention to conditions around you, conditions within you, and your own mind, you can't help but get caught in this deeply conditioned habitual reaction of anger when such conditions arise. Now, where did we ever learn that anger was a skillful response to the situations that we get angry in? Because it isn't a skillful response, mostly. But somehow, our mind still insists on getting angry. Or it still insists on, blaming. Or it still insists on feeling disappointed, or frustrated, or depressed when certain conditions arise. Where in the world did we ever learn that that was a skillful thing to do? Did you ever ask yourself? I mean, certainly you experience anger, irritation, frustration, impatience, depression, right? Sometime. Where did you learn that? Why do we think that that's a good way to deal with a situation like that? Well, some of us don't think it's a good way to deal with it. But it still happens. The mind and its conditioning, well, it's not really yours. It comes, some of it at birth, some of it is put into the mind from our early childhood caregivers, by our culture, by our economic system, our political system, our public school teachers, our private teachers, our spiritual teachers. We learn these unskillful reactions through example. We've been conditioned, we've been trained to respond this way. We've been trained to react this way. What mindfulness or what awareness training does is to show you that, is to show you the conditions that lead to reaction. And understanding that this kind of reaction is suffering. It's suffering to some degree. It may not be excruciating suffering, but it's some level of stress or distress or, you know, a conflict or tension in your life. That's suffering. You don't need to live that way. It's hard to imagine for most of us that we could live without anger, impatience, you know, fear, jealousy, depression, isn't it? It's hard to imagine that it's possible to live less caught by or disentangled from those emotional states that cause so much pain, that cause us to kind of miss so much of life, to disengage from so much of life, to fear so much of life. But it is possible if we pay attention. And that's all we were doing for the 40 minutes that we were sitting in silence. It's just paying attention. We're not trying to fix anything. We're not trying to create anything. We're not trying to avoid anything. We're just trying to see, this is the way it is for me right now. When these conditions happen, this is the emotional reaction, or this is the conditioned or deeply habituated response. If we see that enough times, we begin to recognize it in our life, and we realize, I don't have to go there. I don't have to get angry just because XYZ happens. I don't have to be impatient just because somebody's not on time. I don't have to get afraid just because I don't know what's going to happen next. But it takes paying attention to recognize the situations as they arise, seeing the impulse to react, and exercising some restraint. Just saying, wait a minute. Let me just be with this. And it can be intense. I don't mean to say it's easy. It can be intense. It can be unpleasant. It can provoke a lot of fear. But you can learn to disentangle or decondition your habituated reactions to these very impersonal events that happen in life. Not only is there traffic jams on the way to work, there's traffic jams in our mind. There are so many thoughts and so many emotions and so many judgments and plans and fears jamming, streaming through our mind. It's just a huge traffic jam in there. And knowing what our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our aspirations, our inspirations are takes very careful just paying attention. And in time, we can sort it out. In time, we can just begin to see the patterns of reactivity in the mind. What produces them? And we can step back from them. We're not so caught in the traffic jam. It's kind of like we're hovering above it. And I don't mean we're disconnected from our life, but I mean we're not entangled and smothered by the conditions of life. Do you know what I'm saying? Any of you who've looked at your mind for very long know that this is true. This is what the mind is like. And this is what practice is able to show us. It's just learning the ways of our conditioning and gradually learning a new way of responding rather than reacting to unfolding conditions. So practice, as we did for the silent sitting, is not about getting anything. It's not about creating some kind of special experience. It's not about getting calm. It's not about, you know, getting open. It's just training the mind to pay attention, to recognize this is what's happening right now. This is what's happening, you know, in the body, in the environment, and in the mind. So we begin to recognize the patterns of conditioning that are so impersonal, that have been kind of programmed into the mind before birth, early childhood, and all the way up to this moment. Conditioning. Whatever has been conditioned into the mind can be deconditioned out of the mind. We do not have to live victimized by the dysfunction of our early childhood. We do not. But it takes care. It takes attention. It takes understanding, acceptance, patience. And this is what the whole of Dharma practice is about. It is about doing what is required to begin to and continue to pay attention. And there are all kinds of teachers. There's all kinds of practices. There's all kinds of reflections. And there's just a tremendous storehouse of tools that can help us on the journey. But essentially, all of them are aimed at and aimed towards developing awareness. And that awareness is just the ability to recognize the present moment. That's our responsibility. Recognizing the present moment. No matter what's happening, no matter who's foisting it off on us, no matter what conditions are coming down or coming up, it's our responsibility to recognize and to choose a response rather than get caught in a reaction to the conditions that are happening. It's possible. It's not something we can do overnight. You can't learn it in a 6-week class. You can learn the technique, but you won't know yourself. That will take the rest of your life. It would be better to think of meditation as a marathon rather than a 100-yard dash. And that marathon will last the rest of your life. Because there's every moment there's a new experience arising. Something to be recognized. And if at any moment we don't recognize it, we will fall into a reactive habit. And so there really is no end to the spiritual journey, to the path of awakening, because every moment is a new awakening. There's a new experience to awaken to in every moment. The habit of awareness and recognition and mindfulness grows and is stronger and develops its own momentum, like some of our bad habits or emotional reactive habits now. But you can never kind of rest on your laurels and just say, ah, been there, done that. Been there, done that, then you're caught. If that's what you think, then you're really stuck. You know, and your bad habits are already taking over. So it's a continual reinvesting your aspiration to be awake, to be free, to understand, in the present moment's ability to recognize the present moment. That's pow. In Hawaii, in Hawaiian language, we say pow. It's over. The end. Pow. So, any questions? Or what do you have to say? Yeah, please. Yes.
What about those reactions that are kind of physically expressing themselves that you don't know how to control? They're like physical manifestations of something and you really don't know what that is or what it's doing. So how do you get to that?
Sure. My wife points these out to me all the time. The physical expressions of internal mental states that I am in denial of. Is that what you mean? You know? Oh. Sure. Sure. There is that understanding, you know, that habitual patterns of mind, thoughts, emotions, reactions, can deeply condition functioning of the body. Definitely. You can be, you know, I mean, I don't know. That's not my field of study or expertise, but, you know, someone who is chronically angry will be damaging their liver or their something. Someone who's chronically, you know, depressed is, you know, putting a lot of extra burden on other organs of the body. Now the question was, how do you know this, or how do you work with this, or how do you kind of uncover what the mental component of this physical ailment is? That's kind of what you're asking, I think, huh? Well, I think that it's quite a subtle understanding. But it has to come from paying attention to the present moment. If you investigate that through thinking, I wonder what kind of thoughts are, you know, causing, you know, to make it very simple, what kind of thoughts are causing my cancer, or causing my depression, or causing my acne, or whatever it is. Through thinking, you will only be thinking. You'll be thinking your thoughts, other people's thoughts, you'll be thinking about things you've read, but you won't really uncover the truth for you. So I would like to point you to trying to directly experience your own body. How you feel, you know, your body, what your body feels like. And as you pay attention to the body, you'll notice that, and let me know if this is true. Sometimes you're paying attention to the body and you're trying to feel some area of your body, but your mind keeps slipping off into this fantasy, or it keeps slipping off into this, you know, memory, or keeps slipping off into this, you know, some la-la land. Well, that slipping off into la-la land or fantasy or memory or whatever is not insignificant. So when you're paying attention, you're just paying attention to the present moment and your attention is called to some area of the body and you start to feel some sensations there, just pay attention. Recognize it as sensations. What kind of sensations? Are they strong? Are they weak? Are they changing or whatever? And as you keep paying attention to it, when your mind slips off and you lose the thread of mindfulness, and you get caught in some mental terrain, recognize that. That's a clue for you as to where the mind is and how the mind is affecting the body. The mind and body are talking to each other all the time, aren't they? You know, what's going on in the mind affects the body. What's going on in the body affects the mind. Right? Anybody saying no? I mean, if you're saying no, you're not paying attention. Yeah, it is. And so what we're doing is we're trying to uncover the conversation between the body and the mind. But we have to go into it with a kind of a gentleness, not a demand that to know. But if you go into the body and the mind trying to demand to know, why do I have this, you know, chronic headache? Why do I have... The mind is much too subtle for that kind of muscular manipulation. The mind is much too subtle, much too slippery, much too fast for that kind of gross manipulation. But by paying attention, you can begin to sense or decipher or kind of feel your way into the mind-body conversation, yeah, and begin to understand a little bit of how it happens. What I would be careful of doing is having an agenda to cure your condition. Because it's not that it's not possible, but the intention and the desire to cure and the kind of the manipulation to have that be the goal is going to exert a pressure on the mind that is not going to just let the mind unfold and allow the mind to kind of unfold on its own. It's kind of controlling the mind to do a certain thing. And while the mind can do that, I'm not sure that it's your intention that's going to make the mind do that. Did that? Okay? Okay. Other? Yeah. Yeah. What does it really mean that we learn by example? You know, when the mind of a baby is exposed to certain behavioral reactions and responses, we learn, the baby's mind learns to respond in a certain way. If in your family, or where you were brought up, or with your caregivers, if your parents or your other caregivers responded to difficulty with anger and blame, rather than curiosity to understand it and to address it with some, you know, skill and creativity, then you will also have that conditioning to react to difficulty with anger and blame. You learn it from your parents. You learn that way of reacting to certain situations. Now, there are some emotions that are so powerful that, yes, we feel sadness or we feel loss. And we don't have to learn from anybody what the feeling of loss is to be able to identify it as loss and not get caught in the sadness of it or feeling guilty about it. Well, that's something we learn. But the feeling of loss comes automatically. What we do with that feeling of loss, we learn from our caregivers. Yeah. The feeling of love. Everybody feels love at some point in their life. You know, it's not, you don't have to be special. You don't have to do anything special to feel love. It'll come. Don't worry. But what you do with that, we learn. You know, what you do. Some people feel love and they abuse the person they love or the thing that they love. Some people find other ways of expressing love. But we learn the way of expressing those emotions from our surroundings, our culture, our family, our teachers, our spiritual conditioning, like that. Some of it is skillful, some of it is not. Now it's up to each one of us to pay attention to which of those ways of dealing with the world and all the experiences of the world, which of them are skillful and which are not? Yeah. But we all are going to have the opportunity to feel all of these human emotions, the very unpleasant ones like fear, rage, depression, loss, and the very positive and pleasant ones, love, joy, contentment, fulfillment. Now, what we do with them is something that we learn from our culture, or we learn from our own creativity. You know, if we're paying attention, we can find a new way. We can find our own way of how to express these emotions, if we're paying attention. If not, then you know, habitual reactions will take over for us. Yeah.
You mentioned that when you meditate, you shouldn't have a goal of being calm or being any one thing.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly aware that the mind will take you away for a moment. You want to try to come back for a moment. But can you also use meditation to try to gain insights, to actually sort of focus on a topic?
Yeah. Yes, of course. There are many. Maybe we should define what meditation is, you know, because there are many different kinds of meditation. But in a way, we could say that meditation is working with the mind, isn't it? It's working with the mind primarily, and it's working with what the mind does, how the mind responds, and primarily it's working with how the mind understands a certain situation. So there are meditations of pure reflection. You know, we can reflect on, and a common reflective meditation is loving kindness. We can engender a feeling of love in our heart that becomes stronger the more we do it, merely by reflecting on love and happiness. We can do that. So that's a way of kind of dwelling on a certain topic to fill the heart with that quality. Likewise, now listen to this, if we're not careful and not intentionally directing the mind to dwell on a certain topic, maybe our mind will dwell on fear, just kind of automatically. It just dwells on fear. And if we don't recognize that and we don't catch it and stop it, then we'll become very fearful rather than full of love. But we'll become very fearful. And that's what's going on most of the time. We're dwelling on, obsessing on, you know, fear and insecurity and, you know, self-judgment and judging others and blame. And that's why we feel those states of mind. But in the mindfulness awareness training that I was instructing you in, we were not... The goal of that kind of just awareness training is not to create any particular state of mind. It's not to be calm, but it's to be present in order to understand. Because it's understanding that is going to bring the result of peace of mind. You don't aim for peace of mind. You aim for peace of mind, you're going to get tense and striving and, you know, kind of wound up trying to get calm. You know, that's not the way to calm. The way to calm and the way to peace of mind is through understanding what's in the way of it. It's like, oh, understanding. So we're paying attention in order to understand how things arise, how we get caught in reaction to them, how we can let them go. And through that understanding, then we arrive at, as a result, kind of accidentally, peace of mind. Okay? But imagine this. Say, you sit down, you say, I want to be calm. Okay. I want to be calm, but you're not calm. You've had a rough day. You've had a lot of unfinished conversations, a lot of emotional turmoil. And you say, I want to be calm. And you just, you know, you're struggling with all your anger and your fear and your judgment and your insecurity. And, you know, it's like, I want to be calm. I want to be calm. And you're struggling with the way things are. The way things are is you're not calm, but you want to be calm. And so your agenda to be calm prevents you from being calm. Right? You'd be much better off to say, wait a minute, I don't want to be calm. I want to be clear. I want to understand what is going on. I want to recognize what's going on. And then if you recognize what's going on, you say, you know what? I'm not calm. I'm really upset. Okay, I'm really upset. You know, don't struggle with being upset. But if you can calmly recognize that you're upset, you'll be calm. I mean, it sounds kind of like weird, but that's true. It is. Is that addressing what you were asking, kind of? Yeah. There's many different kinds of meditation. There's many different topics for reflection. But what I was instructing you in is more the just mind, developing mindful awareness in order to recognize the present moment. And the result of some ability to do that is more calmness and peace of mind, understanding. You. Yeah? Sure. Does the mind charge the brain?
That was just something I was wondering about.
Okay.
Well,
let me answer that one first. I have no idea. Okay, next. I mean, the difference in the similarity and the relationship between mind and brain is still being worked out, you know, by, you know, a lot of neuroscientists and, okay, we're still investigating that one. Yes.
That we call our own, and
sure.
That I had wondered if the thought that came to me was that the uniqueness of what I call my mind, while I hold the mind that
yes.
You described that we all
yes.
Have,
yes.
All the same common things.
Yes.
The things in common is the what occurred to me is that my own experiences. Are where the definition might be where I discuss my mind or express my mind versus the other mind.
Sure.
But understand that my mind is capable of all the things I just have those.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure that.
Yeah, I want to comment on that. You're talking about my mind and the uniqueness of my mind, but the commonality of this mind with all minds. I think that that's a false and maybe not really a very helpful way of understanding the mind. I would rather plant this seed of understanding in your mind, that it is the nature of the mind to feel emotions. It is the nature of the mind to think. It is the nature of the mind to know. It is the nature of the mind. So that what is being experienced is just the nature of the body. It's the nature of the mind. It's the nature of environment. It's the natural experience of the mind. Now, the uniqueness that you speak about is your present moment's experience of the nature of the mind, or the nature of thinking, or the nature, the natural activity of the mind. And while the person sitting beside you might be having a totally different experience, she too, or he too, is experiencing nothing other than the nature of the mind. So to speak about it in terms of the uniqueness of my mind and the commonality of our mind, or the mind, is false. It's not particularly helpful. In fact, the understanding that what we're observing in our awareness training is just the nature of the body, the nature of the mind, that understanding is really helpful. It may not feel like that's your experience. You may not think, this is the nature of the mind? It feels like my mind. Well, that belief, it's my mind, is what's causing all the problems in your life. I know, but you know, you can't just take that thought or that belief out of your mind. It's in there. You know, and so I'm planting a seed. Listen, the understanding that what is being observed is just the nature of the mind and the nature of the body. It's not my mind and my body. It's the nature of the mind. And any body that feels that, or any mind that feels that, experiences that, is going to experience the same thing. When you experience sadness, let's take something simpler. When you experience heat, you know, we close all the windows, we turn up the heat, and you experience heat. You, generally speaking, you know, experience heat. Is your experience of heat any different than my experience of heat? Huh? Ooh. There may be, you know, there may be.
Somebody who weighs more is going to be hotter sooner and hotter longer and hotter to a, you know, higher temperature than somebody who's really skinny.
That may be true, but heat is heat, right? Heat is heat. We recognize heat because it has a certain direct experience. You know, I mean, it's hard to describe just what heat is. But and while there may be an individual reaction of hotter or cooler or degrees or where you feel it in the body or how soon it happens, nevertheless, the feeling of heat is... Maybe you don't believe that. Aha. Okay. Let me back off of this. But that's something to ask yourself, you know, not to debate with me, but just to ask yourself, is the experience of, you know, cold or heat the same? It's the nature of cold. It's the nature of heat. It's not like there's a real thing there. It's the nature of cold. When you experience the nature of cold, it is the same as someone else experiencing the nature of cold. Now, don't, just because I'm sitting up here and you're sitting down there, don't believe that. But open the possibility in your mind that, okay, we're talking about the nature of heat, the nature of cold, the nature of sadness, the nature of pain, the nature of fear, the nature of thought. And if it's just, go ahead. Why does it matter? Because. Yeah. Because in that, when you recognize that what is being experienced by the mind in that chair is totally impersonal. It is not yours. There's nothing about it that is personal. Then that begins to open the door to an understanding of what's going on here that is very freeing and that cannot be reached without that understanding. Now, whether you experience it the same as I experience it, that's not the important point. The important point is to see that what's being experienced is the impersonal, natural unfolding of cause and effect, or the nature of mental and physical phenomena. Hard to get, hard understanding to confirm through experience. But you plant the seed, you know, you've heard it from me, and you may hear it from others. I planted the seed. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to believe it. You can even disagree with it. But as you keep practicing and paying attention, that understanding is going to work in the background of your mind, and you're going to keep looking. You know, some part of your mind is going to keep looking and see, is that true or not? You know, and someday if you keep looking, you'll see. We have a lot of memories that we think are mine. And we have a lot of experience about mine. We have a lot of belief about mine. It's my body, my mind, my experience, my fear, my emotional reactions. But actually, we haven't seen clearly that this is just the nature of the mind, the nature of the body. Is that, that's probably hard to accept. I'm getting a sense that, ooh, that's pretty hard to accept. That's okay. Don't look. Awareness doesn't require dogmatic belief. You don't have to believe anything. But you do have to pay attention. And how you pay attention is important. If you pay attention seeking to confirm, this is my body and this is my mind, that's all you'll ever do. But if you pay attention in order to free yourself from suffering, then you have to open yourself to other possibilities. And that's what you'll do. Yeah? Yeah, you? Process.
And the uniqueness that we get confused with as the objects.
Content.
Yes. So, you know, so for example, the uniqueness of whatever the experiences.
There's one.
The story then becomes what we think is us.
Yeah.
All of the objects that have felt.
Around the sense of me. Yeah. That's true. A lot of the, one way of understanding is just like you said, that the content of the emotions, for example, gets identified with me. We claim it as mine. And then the sense of self is the one who experiences that fear, that sadness, that joy. I call that the content. The process of sadness, the process of fear, the process of joy is not unique to that mind. It would happen to any mind in a similar situation. The content may be different, yeah? but the process, to use your word, is same. It is the nature of the mind to feel sadness in such situations. Yeah. Yeah, the guy back there? How would I explain the difference?
Describe the difference between reaction and response.
Yeah, oh, that's a good question. I do make a distinction between reaction and response. And my definition my difference is that reaction is a deeply conditioned habit which is often unconscious. And response is a non-habitual capacity to respond to the situation with understanding and through presence of mind. So because you're there for the situation and you see it as it is and you see the options for how to respond to it and you choose the one that leads to least suffering for you and others. But in reaction, you know, you don't even see the situation. You're just reacting out of deeply conditioned habits which you're not aware of. That's how I make the distinction between reaction and response. Yeah?
But when you're responding like that, isn't it the mind that's making that choice?
Good question. When you're responding like that, now you have some awareness of the situation, and there is a response, and you're saying, isn't it the mind that is making that choice? Right? That's what you asked me. Yes. But what in the mind is making the choice? Wisdom. Wisdom, because it's wisdom that understands, is making the choice. It's not, I mean, when I spoke about reaction to him, reaction is the choice, but it's a choice of ignorance. Ignorance reacts this way. Wisdom responds that way. So it's not the reaction or the responding that we need to pay attention to. It's the ignorance or delusion or the wisdom in understanding. That's why I was telling you, somebody, that the goal of this whole practice is understanding. If we understand, wisdom will be there. And then you'll have the capacity to respond rather than react in every situation. Are you skeptical or are you just... No, you all right?
No,
yeah.
I don't
feel
that.
So if I'm hard to look out...
Say it again?
So if this is a little hard to look out.
Yeah.
It's like something happens, some challenge, okay.
Yeah.
So if you just sort of unreflectively do your habitual thing,
yeah.
You know, that would be a reaction. But then if you think about it too much, then
find it either, because then you're just going to get into more habitual.
Oh, yeah. Now, I didn't say, now he's asking me about, if you think about it too much, you're just going to get into more of that habitual stuff. Now, when I say respond instead of react, I'm not talking about thinking about anything. I'm talking about being so aware of it. You're not thinking about it. You're aware of it. Do you know the difference between being aware of something and thinking about something? You know, when you're sad, let's not take sadness. Let's take loss. There's an experience of loss in your life. Someone dies, you lose a job, neighbor moves away, your car gets crashed. You know, there's a feeling of loss, right? Now, this feeling of loss will, for most of us, automatically condition a sense of grief if it's a person, anger if it's an accident like your car or something, or blame. The feeling of loss is unpleasant. And so, mostly we have an aversive reaction, not response, reaction to loss. And one of the reactive feelings to loss is grief. Okay? Now, if we think about loss, we can just keep spiraling into more and more grief. The loss and the person, and we're never going to see him again, and oh, poor me, and blah, 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 blah. And we can get caught in grief, thinking that we're really doing a good thing. But that's just being caught. That's being caught in a reaction to the feeling of loss, not being able to feel the experience of loss and accept it and respond differently. Awareness.
Yeah, but there's awareness, but then, okay, so you're aware, then you can be aware of a lot of things, so that doesn't necessarily lead to action. What leads to wise action? I don't think that's really been explained as yet.
Okay, what leads to wise action? After there's awareness, what leads to wise action, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so through awareness, we begin to understand how or what kinds of actions leads to suffering, right? We see, if I'm not careful, if I'm not paying attention, I react habitually, and then I get caught in some painful mental state, or someone else gets dumped on. But when there's awareness, then there's the capacity to be with unpleasant or pleasant states, and just in that capacity, the mind knows how to respond without causing suffering. It's understanding. It's through wisdom. You see.
It's not really adding any explanation.
No. Let me just say that kind of knowledge comes, that's what insight is. Insight always involves this moment in the mind where you're seeing something, and you go, ah. You have a new understanding. Insight is a new understanding of the way that is. And out of that new understanding, you will respond differently than you reacted previously. Now, I can't tell you where that insight comes from, but it does come from awareness and understanding the situation more fully or more completely or more precisely. It comes from understanding. And then the choice of how to respond is easier, so to speak. Oh, a lot of questions. Okay, one more. Yeah?
Is your training in Buddhism?
Is mine?
No, it's in the Eightfold Path. When you meditate, do you actually work in the context of what the Buddha taught?
My general understanding, yes, is, I do practice the Buddhist teachings, and I do have the general understanding of the Buddha's Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. What we're talking about is first noble truth, suffering in all of its forms, right? Second noble truth, attachment that causes that suffering in all of its forms. Third noble truth, which is the freedom from suffering that comes from awareness and ultimately leads to the freedom from all suffering, nibbana, And the way you're doing that is through practicing the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is divided into three trainings, if you will. There's a training in sila, or learning how to live in harmony with one another and yourself. Samadhi, which is learning how to train the mind so it's not caught in these habitual reactions. And panya, which is learning how to understand things correctly. And that's what I'm talking about. I've been talking about Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path all night. Right? Completely. That's all I've been talking about. Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Experience, how they are experienced, you know, in the mind that's aware, in the mind that's not aware. I didn't say. Now we're going to talk about the First Noble Truth. The First Noble Truth is suffering. But every time I mentioned the word fear, anger, suppression, you know, that's First Noble Truth. That's suffering. Every time I talked about attachment, identification, and being habituated or reactive, I'm talking about attachment, Second Noble Truth. Every time I talk about mindfulness and how to find, how to be with experience in a new and fresh way in each moment, Third Noble Truth. Every time I talk about being aware, Fourth Noble Truth, the path. That's all I've been talking about the whole night. Sorry. It's true. I just didn't put it in the... I have a great talk on the Four Noble Truths, if you want to hear that. True. Yeah, that's a good point. I want to thank you for that, and I want to just repeat it. You know, that a lot of times, and correct me if I didn't quite hear you, but a lot of times meditation is taught without the context of the Buddha's understanding and the Buddha's teachings, and it doesn't always lead to the liberation that the Buddha pointed to. You can find all, I mean, I tell you, there's a lot of mental terrain to be discovered through paying attention. And without a kind of a proper context and understanding going into it, you can come out a mess. And so really, I tell you, you go rummaging around in the mind without some proper guidance and understanding, you can get into trouble. So the context of the Eightfold Path, developing the paramis for the foundation for paramis, the forces of purity, before a practice or as a vehicle of practice, really important and helpful. That's true. Yeah. I just want to mention it's 9 o'clock. I don't know what time we're supposed to end, but I think it's usually around now, huh? So I'll take one more question.
Well, you say each of us has a responsibility to our mind.
Yes. Good question. It directly addresses what, I don't know your name, but what he was asking, because the Fourth Noble Truth is about the Eightfold Path. Now think about this. If you're living in a neighborhood where one person is a thief, but you don't know which one, then you view all of your neighbors with suspicion, and everybody has to lock their door at night. On the other hand, and everybody would be affected by one thief in the neighborhood, right? On the other hand, if you, in your attempt to understand your own mind, come to some deep realization of the way things are, you free your mind, you live in harmony with yourself, you live in harmony with one another, you practice generosity, you're patient, and you're really a kind of a benevolent person, you too will have as much effect on everyone you come in contact with as that thief does in that neighborhood. Every moment of practicing awareness is a gift that you're giving everyone you live with. Because to the extent that you understand your mind and how you get caught and suffer, you understand their mind and how they get caught and suffer, and that can't help but make you more compassionate. And compassion is the vehicle for healing. relationships and personal within yourself and in relationships with one another and between societies, and it's the foundation of peace within and peace without. You want to bring peace into the world? Huh? Practice meditation. If it's not in here, you're not going to make it out there. It's true. So, it's been wonderful to kind of connect with you again and to hear your questions and to kind of challenge you a little bit and to offer some suggestions and advice. And please don't stop here. You know, the path is long, but it's a joyful long. You know, if you have the right attitude, you can really enjoy this discovery of, you know, how it is, and disentangle your heart from reactions and cultivate the capacity to respond to all that your life will offer. Be well.